I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
I'm Angelie Preston.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We're going to have some real healing. We've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity, and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
This is What's Next. I'm Thomas O'Neill White, and today we are talking about a subject that I believe is of interest to much of our listenership, even if they don't want to admit it, and that is adult recreational marijuana use. Joining me today is the co-owner and operator of Public Flower Dispensary on Allen Street, Sheldon Anderson. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
So Public Flower is the first black and woman-owned licensed adult-use cannabis dispensary in the city of Buffalo. It's quite the milestone.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it feels it's a great accomplishment. Definitely thankful to the state Office of Cannabis Management for, giving us this opportunity. Also just definitely thankful to the New York State Assembly Majority Leader, Crystal People Stokes, who championed this legislation. Also, State Senator Liz Krueger as well, and obviously Governor Kathy Hochul for, all of the advocacy in Albany. It's definitely been a great opportunity, and it hasn't even been a month yet, but it definitely feels like a great experience so far, and I could definitely see the potential of more licensing opening up for more minorities and women. And we want to try to be helpful to those who are wanting to be in the industry as well, in the legal industry, plant touching or not plant touching, but definitely just humble and grateful for the opportunity for sure.
So yeah, let's talk about that support. You guys opened up shop. It's been, you said, about a month now.
Yeah. So we got our approvals from the state. I want to say like the second Tuesday of February, I believe, in 2024. And we started off doing a lot of online ordering, accepting walk-in traffic as well. I think about a week after that, I think it was on the 19th, we then had a press event. We invited different elected officials. The Assembly Majority Leader Crystal People Stokes was there, Councilmember Mitch Nowakowski from the Fillmore District, Council Majority Leader Leah Halton Pope was there from the Ellicott District. We also had the Allentown Association President, Patty McDonald, there as well. And basically what we did was just highlighted the fact that we are open, we're taking online orders, we're open for business, but we were open already for a few days before that, just trying to just iron out some of the kinks and work through some of just, it's kind of like opening up a restaurant. You got to make sure that, your toasters, microwaves, and cash registers all work and
right,
handle your flow.
So make sure the knives are sharp and all that stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, for sure.
So, I mean, what does it mean to you? And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention your partner, the other co-owner, Mariah Kelly, yeah, in this. What did it mean to you to have that kind of support from local and state officials?
It meant a lot. I mean, like, Mariah's family has been in entrepreneurial space in Buffalo. I'm originally from New York City. Mariah's, been born and raised in Buffalo. I think, even before we even considered applying for a license, we, in our travels, we would go to Amsterdam or Los Angeles or Seattle. Any place that we would go, we would always try to find, the local cannabis scene to not only participate, but also to just to kind of get an idea of what it looks like to run and operate, a business. I think it was an eye-opening experience when Mariah and I were both in Amsterdam, and you're able to get you can get a porterhouse steak, a glass of whiskey, and you can get whatever cannabis-infused option you want, and it's all in one. Going to different smoke lounges. I like soccer or just sports in general, but when we were in Amsterdam, obviously soccer is a big thing. It was a great experience being able to watch a soccer match, you know, enjoy some good flower.
Right.
And then also just, you know, just be around people who, you know, is a lot more accepting, and just from, you know, instead of it being like back in the States when it was not adult use, like approved in New York State, you know, to do something like that, you would have to be a very private underground scene, but it was just a lot more comforting. But yeah, no, Mariah and I are super excited about the opportunity. And, you know, every day we're owner operators. We're there talking to the customers, building that rapport with people, and we're enjoying it, helping people along their journey from, you know, understanding that they like certain types of gummies, but then they can learn a little bit more about the different options that are there, the different flower options for, and helping people understand. Some people come in, they don't know the difference between sativa, indica, hybrid, or sometimes they kind of confuse the two. So it's always great just to educate people just a little bit.
You know? Yeah, that's important.
Yeah.
What's one of the more important things you learned from your travels and checking out these spots where recreational use has been legal for some time, and how businesses operate in those areas?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's a retail experience. You need to have good customer service. You need to have people there that are patient and are good problem solvers. You know, I know you mentioned that you're from D.C. I remember we were in D.C. And we went to some of the sticker shops that they had there. This is before I think it was even legalized in the D.C. area. And you would go in there and it would be like buy a stick of gum, and then you can go into the other back room, and then that's where they have all the cannabis and different flower, things like that. And in that environment, you know, they're playing, you know, music really loud. It kind of feels like a mashup of different vibes, and it's never feeling like a good customer experience.
Yeah.
And you'll have people working there who are, you know, they're not giving you any type of education. It's just like, this is what we got. This is the prices.
Take it or leave it. Yeah.
And which is, you know, that's, but again, they're running an illegal shop. So, you know, but there are some illicit shops that have more of a customer, you know, a better customer experience. In other states and in other countries, I think we'll go up to Toronto a lot. Mariah and I will go up to Toronto. The one thing that I noticed would be the difference between a well-run cannabis establishment and one that's just run as if it's like not really any plan there. It's just kind of people hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I got to appreciate was just the importance of running it like a serious business. It's not like a community hangout.
Right, spot. Right.
It's a place where people can learn about the plant, learn about the options, learn about different ways to consume. But definitely want it to be warm and inviting. Like on Allen Street, we have curtains that are open. You can see out, you can see in. It's well lit. And, you know, people really appreciate that. It's a safe environment. You know, you can't just walk in. You have to get buzzed in. You have to show ID. You have to be 21 and up. And so I feel like, you know, in our travels, we've seen good experiences. We've seen, you know, good practices and bad practices. So we try to take from the good.
Right. Okay. And so talk to me about CARD. C-A-U-R-D is the acronym, Conditional Adult Use Retail Dispensary. You're an applicant. Kind of take us through the process from applicant to getting your license, and also like the conditional adult use retail dispensary application. Like, how did you get into that in the first place?
Yeah, well, again, applause to the Office of Cannabis Management. I think they have great leadership and great a great mission. And, you know, at the time, it was, I believe it was in either late spring or summer of 2022, you know, effectively their kind of like their entire leadership came to Buffalo for a workshop, more or less, on the CARD license program. Kind of almost as like a rollout. Here's a program that we're rolling out. And the Assembly Majority Leader was there as well. And they did a great job explaining what their vision is for the program, everything from the fees. They kind of did it like in a town hall fashion where they took questions. And I thought that was that was great. You know, it felt like they were able to answer a lot of questions and provide at least like some level of, you know, clarity about what it's all going to take. And mm-hmm. they explained, like, for example, one thing I remember, they talked about the license fee was $2,000. And so they even addressed the fact that it's, you know, their goal is not to make money off the licensing fee. It's just to, you know, ensure that people who want to be in the space are serious about the space. I don't think that if they made the licensing fee $1, I mean, they probably would have like, I don't know, 10x the number of license applications. Mm-hmm. But the card program, learning about it, you had to be justice involved, either yourself or someone in your family had to have had a marijuana conviction. And, you know, they did.
Was that something that was in your family?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, my family has been impacted by, you know, the war on drugs, over policing,
mm-hmm.
you know, whatever, you know, term you want to put on it. But 11234 is a zip code that I grew up in New York City, in Brooklyn, New York. And again, the Office of Cannabis Management, they've done a great job explaining and showing the data in, like, I believe it's in one of their equity reports that talks about the over policing and
yeah.
And it literally shows you like almost like a heat zone, like mapping of like, this is the zip codes of where there was, you know, over policing and disproportionate enforcement of police, you know, activity in these zip codes. And so, you know, my parents were impacted, arrested, served time as well. Myself, I've had, you know, run-ins with law enforcement, but nothing where it rose to the level where I served any time or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, just growing up in New York City, I mean, like I played high school sports, and I remember just being, you know, more or less harassed. It would be like four of us walking together, and, you know, they'll say, hey, stop, let's search your bags. I'm just like, it's just basic, like, you know, just
right. That's quit. The right. The stop and frisk era, right?
Yeah, that was, you know, it was like, I guess, Bloomberg at the time.
Yeah,
Giuliani Bloomberg wrote that. I don't know. All I know is when, you know, and, you know, I'm not anti-police or anything like that, but I know at the time, you know, definitely felt like the NYPD at the time was like, you know, you didn't necessarily only feel, you didn't really feel warm and fuzzy when you saw him. And so,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it definitely was something that was a reality. And I think now, you know, definitely it's interesting now. It was law enforcement here in Buffalo, Buffalo Police, in the legal market, you know, their techs, you know, the more we succeed as retail dispensaries, the more local money stays in Buffalo in terms of taxes. So
uh-huh.
that goes to police uniforms, vests, you know, police cars, things like that. So, and the Buffalo police have been doing a great job on Allen Street, but also, you know, throughout the city.
Mm-hmm.
I think one thing to highlight for Buffalo police is how they handled the 514
right.
incident. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, that could have ended a lot more badly. And so
true.
I think, you know, definitely we have a great police force here in Buffalo for sure.
As a quick aside, because you're from Brooklyn, who's your favorite Brooklyn rapper?
I mean, I just gotta go with Jay-Z. It's just,
yeah, over Big.
Yeah, I just, yeah, I mean, it was funny, I quoted Biggie recently. There was a lawyer, you know, he said that I have lawyers watching lawyers so I don't go broke. you know, but yeah, I mean, you know, Jay-Z, he has a line where he talks about in a song called Smile, on his album 444, where he talks about, you know, basically he's talking about black equity and black entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking about how, you know, weed is legal in Colorado, but they'll deny, you know, black enterprise. And so, you know, he has had friends and that he's grown up with that have been trying to be in the legal space. And again, based upon that disproportionate enforcement of marijuana prohibition, oftentimes you have black and brown people serving time, but now, you know, it's legal in Colorado. So it's interesting how he says that and kind of phrases it. And he's actually an investor, I believe, in Flow Hub, which is a cannabis point of sale company as well. So he, you know, and I believe Jay-Z also has his hands in, I think it's Monogram, I believe, or he has his, like,
he's got his hands in a lot of things.
Yeah, he's, you know, he's a you know, a savvy business person. But, you know, I think that's one of the things, too, is I think it's just, you know, Jay-Z's, you know. I remember when I was younger, when it was announced, when Biggie had passed, I remember hearing it on the radio.
Same.
As a kid. Mm-hmm. So, you know, definitely, I'll rap my Biggie pretty hard, but you know, I feel like Jay-Z's message just kind of resonates with me, and just as a from a youth to an old man right now.
Yeah, he's definitely Jay-Z's the kind of like the grown folk kind of rap. You know, yeah. I bought his first album, Reasonable Doubt, when I was 13, and it was just, he was talking about things that I right. just, when I got into like my later, mid to later 30s, I was like, oh, okay, I get what he's saying now.
Right, no, absolutely, yeah.
So would you say with going through the process from application to getting your license, was that a tough road to hoe? To get to where you are now?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of patience and a lot of just trying to keep your composure. Like, so for example, we applied for the car license in September of 2022. And one of the reasons I know the timeline really well, because my birthday's in September.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember like a week or so after my birthday, I applied, put in all of the paperwork. Okay, great. In that January of 2023, they awarded the approvals for some stores to open, I think, in upstate and in downstate. In that time, there was lawsuits that were filed.
Oh, right. And, I remember that.
And Mariah, you know, definitely Mariah definitely went into the legal, you know, dictionary, in a sense. We started logging into these it's like basically log into court records and kind of see what's going on, because
uh-huh.
we're trying to figure out like what is going on, and it's like we kind of turned into like you know, paralegals or something. It felt like you know, temporary restraining order, injunctions,
yes,
that and the third, and it's just like, oh geez, right? But yeah, so from September of 2022, it took up until July of 2023 for us to actually get the provisional approval. And we were provisionally approved in the July board meeting with the Office of Cannabis Management and Control Board. After that, we got our approvals to open in February of 2024. So from September 2022 up until February 2024. And so wow. I would say 99% of the issue was based upon the lawsuits and legal actions taken by some out-of-state entities and in-state entities.
Yes.
You know, and I don't really kind of blame the Office of Cannabis Management for that delay. I think, you know, if you want to be in the cannabis space, you have to look at it as a long-term endeavor and a long-term, you know, play and position. And they've done a great job leading with equity, you know, I think at least like a third or about roughly the third of the operators that have licenses for retail in New York State are black owned, which is huge.
Mm-hmm.
Nationwide, I think we make up less than 1% of the adult use retail space. And then when you drill it down further with, you know, black women, it's significantly lower than that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the Office of Cannabis Management, they just announced that there was a black owned, woman owned dispensary in Brooklyn. That opened up, I think she actually purchased, it used to be a former Chase Bank, and then she converted it into a dispensary. I don't recall the name, but I think that that's been something that's been very, very positive and promising, is that
yes.
New York State's going to be like an equity, you know, model.
Mm-hmm. And we just had a minority and woman-owned dispensary open in the town of Tonawanda.
Yep.
Last week.
Buffalo
Dreams.
Yep. Great people over there.
Yes.
B and Jamie, they have a great location. You know, sometimes with me and Ryan and I, we go to Whole Foods, and so it's
right over there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a great location. I think, you know, it's great to see that, you know, there's going to be more women, more minorities in the space. I know that, you know, it's something that is a part of the law. And that equity component for that was part of the vision of Assembly Majority Leader People Stokes and State Senator Liz Krueger. I just applaud them and also the governor for continuing and actually delivering on that mission, because it could have easily been diluted or scrapped or put aside.
Right.
But I think, you know, New York's a very diverse state, and so we should have a lot more diversity in the ownership of these licensed shops.
Yeah, and you know, much was made of what a lot of people were saying was mismanagement from the state with regard to adult use retail dispensaries. But you, people can look at you and say, well, this guy made it.
Right.
Like, what would you say to those people who are would say the state's not doing it right? They should be doing it a different way.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some people that are just anti-government just in general.
Right.
I mean, there's, you know, for example, I got an enhanced license recently. And, you know, when you go into the DMV, like, I'll give you, this is a perfect example. So the first time I was going there for one thing, and then I was like, yeah, I should do my enhanced license. I didn't have all the paperwork with me. So I came back the next time, I figured out what paperwork is needed and brought all the paperwork. You know, some people go to the DMV, they got bubblegum on their paper, they got half the paper, they don't know what's what. And then they're like, well, why aren't you helping me? Oh, the state's the issue. So it just, you know, that's just kind of baked into it. You're going to get people that complain about government no matter what. I think, you know, people just need to, a lot of this is all public information. It's just researching. If you were to apply for a liquor license, there's a delay, there's a wait. There's like at least 6,000 delinquent liquor license you know, applications. And so that takes time. You know, it can take you a year or 2 years for a liquor license. So the fact that they were able to green light, and liquor is federally legal, right? It's not a federally illegal substance. So I feel like the fact that they're able to do that and have equity as well, I don't think there's really kind of any like mismanagement. If anything, you know, they were given a lot of goals and objectives, but I feel like they were like underfunded and under resourced. And so as they get more resources, they're going to be more efficient. But I think, with when it comes to just government in general, it's not a speedboat. It's like a battleship or something, like a
cruise.
It's supposed to be slow. So if you're going into it thinking that you're gonna, you know, you're not gonna go into the DMV, get a driver's license printed out, like, you know, like immediately. You know what I mean? Like, so some people just got to be patient, and some people just, you know, are just impatient. So you can't really
can't help them.
No, I mean, I get it. I mean, you know, but yeah, I try to be more patient just in general.
So why set up shop in Allentown? What about the neighborhood made you say, I want to run my business here?
Yeah, well, Mariah and I, we both live on the west side in the city of Buffalo, so we wanted to be close to the business. We wanted a location that had great foot traffic, great, you know, vehicular traffic, a part of the city that's known for retail, and you know, having a strong commercial corridor that has like advocacy, because I think that's important. The Allentown Association was super helpful in welcoming us, and we got a letter of support from them. And then also too, there's certain pockets or certain zones in the city of Buffalo that work for retail. You have, you know, like for example, 716 Dank, it's owned by Aaron. And you know, it's a great team over there. They're in a great location because they're right downtown. But you know, you have Hurdle, you have Premier Earth on Hurdle. There's a lot of different pockets in the city. Like, you have certain stretches of Hurdle that are great retail locations. You have certain sections of Elmwood that are good retail locations. And then you also have, you know, Allentown. So Allentown was kind of one of those that kind of checked a lot of boxes. And you know, once I was able to connect with the landlord who was willing to, you know, lease us the space and kind of laid out a vision, I think we talked for like a little bit more than an hour, maybe an hour or two. I can't recall how long, but, you know, I think after that we had a letter of intent signed pretty much within a few days after getting awarded. So it was a combination of getting a location that was within the requirements of the law, which I think you can't be within 200 feet or 500 feet of a school or church. I get them confused all the time in my head, but I know it's 200 and 500. And so, you know, but that was the most important. So that kind of checked off a lot of boxes. I think we, you know, the community has been super welcoming, and we're more than happy to be in Allentown and be a part of the fabric.
Yeah. Any particular words of advice from any of the store owners along Allen?
I would say a lot of them have given advice about crowd control, just ensuring that you're understanding that you're going to get a great mix of people that come down on Allen Street. So just trying to, you want to be as welcoming, but you also want to have a retail experience that's safe and friendly for everyone. In Allentown, there's First Fridays, so where a lot of the businesses, they kind of open their doors and welcome people in. We're a licensed dispensary, so we have like security and control measures. We can't necessarily do that, but we keep our windows open. You can see in, you can see out, and it's pretty safe. We have security like measures on our windows and things like that, so that way there's not going to be any issues. We have cameras, things like that. But a lot of business owners in Allen have just been super supportive. And been willing to provide us with, some cross promotion. They've been willing to, share with their customers that there's a dispensary on the street. But a lot of it, I think, has been taking responsibility for your business has been a consistent theme or message. So making sure that your doors are locked, making sure that your alarms are on, simple things like that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of business owners have just kind of preached a lot of the basics, keeping the sidewalk clean, things like that.
Where do you see your business in 5 years?
Hopefully we can get other locations in the city of Buffalo. Hopefully we're able to have delivery up and running, and ultimately just hopefully we're able to get our license renewed, because I believe it's a 3-year license. And so we will want to be renewed again and be good stewards of the license, demonstrate that we're able to generate a lot of tax revenue for the locality, the city of Buffalo, and also the state. And hopefully we're able to continue to have it renewed and be able to kind of grow from there. We can't really do anything in the cultivation space because it's a two-tier market where you can't do retail and cultivation. In an ideal world, it'd be nice to kind of understand and learn in that space with the cultivation. But I think ultimately just continuing to provide, a great retail experience that's open from anywhere from, 10 a.m. to midnight. That's what we want to do, is to basically be able to have as much coverage of hours, so that way people who start their day early or are getting home from work, I think we just want to continue to be a place where people can get licensed, safe, tested cannabis, in an adult use setting. Because there are sticker shops, different illicit operators, people who don't have storefronts. And unfortunately, sometimes that can have a negative impact on just in cannabis, because some people will come in and say, hey, I had a really bad edible experience. And sometimes you say, well, where'd you get the edibles? And then it's kind of like, I don't remember.
Yeah.
That's half the problem. So knowing that you can get an edible from the same place, from the same vendors, or even a variety of vendors, but that it's licensed and tested, you're going to get more people who have more positive associations with the plant versus somebody who's selling brownies out of their grandma's basement. And then you're like, well, I'm just going to try this, and then it doesn't turn out well. So we're just trying to. I think in the next 5 years, we want to continue to just run an efficient shop.
Yeah. Are there parameters to renewal? Obviously, if you're like not making money, they're probably not going to renew your license. But like, what do you are there like certain numbers you have to hit in order to get renewed for your license?
Not off the top of my head, I don't believe there's any like criteria. Like if they say, oh, you're not making enough money, we're not going to renew you. But I think it's more so like compliance with the regulations as it relates to marketing,
hours,
keeping up with your compliance of inventory management, things like that. So if you're running a shop, it's just like the liquor authority. If you have 30 911 calls for your dispensary, that's not going to look well when you go to renew.
Mm-hmm.
That's why some liquor stores close, or either from the state or the municipality. Like if you have the state liquor authority, when it's time to renew the liquor license, they'll go to the municipality, show me the 911, 311, etc., community complaints, etc. Are you letting minors in? Things like that. I would assume that's probably where OCM will probably not renew someone, is if you're if you're letting a bunch of 18-year-olds come in and buy cannabis, that likely lowers the chances that you'll be renewed for a license. But more so than if you didn't make $10 million in a year. Mm-hmm. That's my assumption generally. Yeah.
And so you're not just selling flower. For those who have never been in a dispensary, don't know what dispensaries are all about, what other products do you have?
So we have obviously flower and pre-rolls. So we have AFES, so that's 3.5 grams of flower. And that flower can be a sativa, indica, or hybrid. We have tinctures, which can be taken out of like a little dropper and mm-hmm. add that to your coffee or your juice or whatever. And that's sometimes we have some that are good for all times of the day, or also some that have more of a nighttime desired effect. We have gummies that have 3 milligrams of melatonin in it, as well as THC and CBN. We have gummies that have B3, B6, and B12 in it. So there's a host of gummy options. We have drinks as well that are 1-to-1 THC CBD. Some of them are 2-to-1. So you'll get 5 milligrams of THC, 5 milligrams of CBD for the 1-to-1s. For the 2-to-1s, you get 10 milligrams of THC and then 5 milligrams of CBD. And so those are good products. And to be honest with you, the flavor profile on some of the drinks is pretty good. I mean, a lot of samples that we get are infused, so we can get a sense of the flavor profile of the gummies. And we ensure that what we have on the shelves have great ingredients, whether it's, you know, some people have certain dietary restrictions, so we make sure that they're either vegan or gluten-free, or we have a great understanding of what's in those ingredients, because that's important. We also have balms that you can like actually put on your elbows or joints that you can like roll on. We have chocolates, like caramel, like they kind of look like small mini Twixes, but they're pretty good as well. So we have a host of options. So yeah, I think that's one thing that's awesome. And also too, vape cartridges. There are some people who come in and they're very comfortable with gummies. Some of them come in and they're very comfortable with drinks. And so I think it's always great to see people who are trying out these products. And a lot of times it's referrals too. People come in because they say, hey, I was at my friend's house and they had a certain drink by this company. So for example, Heirloom is a company that makes a lot of beverages and vape cartridges and tinctures. And they say, yeah, I had this Honeycrisp drink. It was really good. I want 2 cases of that. So I think a lot of it is, as people in the adult use market, just like with a good bottle of wine, if you try it out, then you're just going to come to the wine shop, or in this case, an adult use cannabis dispensary to check it out. I mean, our building is a former apothecary that was built in 1892 by Eli Hosmer. He was, there's an actual Buffalo business directory from that time, and his title was a druggist. So he actually sold different tinctures and things like that for like headaches and things like that. Because back in those days, turn of the century, that's one of the forms of medicine that they would utilize. And so, when you come into our store, you have the exposed brick, the original hardwood floors, and just a great, clean, warm, inviting retail experience.
What words of advice would you give someone looking to get into this business who has a similar background to you?
I would say definitely you want to understand and have a vision for what you want to do. Do you want to be plant touching or do you not want to be plant touching? If you want to be plant touching, then you have to really research the different license criteria from the Office of Cannabis Management. If possible, find an attorney, because there's going to be situations where you're going to have to have documentation of whether you're having agreements with partners, or you're taking on new investors, or you need to have a roadmap. They're going to kind of help you, because they may already have had clients who navigated it, so they'll be able to kind of lean in and kind of give you that advice. But also too, if you're not going to be plant touching, you may be somebody who's a great public relations or marketing company or consultant. You can work with cannabis companies as well. So I think try to understand what your niche is, and work with people who are in the industry. We're always happy to connect with people. Our website is publicflower.co. On our website, we have our email address and our phone number, so we're more than happy to talk with people and provide some of that guidance and connect them to other people who are in that space where they can do a lot of the, you know, not hand-holding, not necessarily, but just helping them get a sense and grapple over, like, what they actually want to do in the space. Because it can be a lot to some people, because literally people come into the store, they have questions for us, and we try to help them understand that, you know, you got to really try to spend that time and understand exactly what you want to do and have a why behind it, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you just want to be in cannabis because you think it's cool, I don't know. I mean, you know, just because you think wine is cool, that doesn't mean open up a wine shop either.
Right.
You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. that's where it's kind of like you got to have that understanding of the why and the driven, you know, what's driving your purpose to be in cannabis.
What's the difference between plant touching and non-plant touching?
So, for example, plant touching would be a retail dispensary where we take an inventory that has THC in it.
Okay.
Whether it's flower, drinks, etc. But, you know, another plant touching would be like logistics or a processor. But non-plant touching would be a bank.
Okay.
Or an attorney or a marketing company.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. So like those ancillary businesses that get support from the cannabis consultants who work in cannabis, lobbyists, those are all non-plant touching. So I think that's where sometimes people have to kind of understand that. Just understanding that navigating that. Because once you're plant touching, then you have to really understand the legalities of it. You have to understand banking. You have to understand what you're going to do with your cash. There's a lot of things you have to consider.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're listening to What's Next. I want to thank my guest, Public Flower co-owner and operator, Sheldon Anderson, for being here today. We'll be back with more after this.
Join WBFO every Saturday at 6 p.m. for an insightful and enlightening series of audio documentaries from our region that tackle topics such as the environment, health, the world of entertainment, and more. Listen to the WBFO DocuHour every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on WBFO, your NPR station.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
This is What's Next on WBFO. We've been talking about cannabis dispensaries in New York State, and now we're joined by someone who knows quite a bit about the legalities and the bookkeeping of those businesses. Paula Collins is an attorney specializing in tax preparation and cannabis law. Paula, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So let's start with kind of a very basic question. So you work closely with cannabis business owners, especially as it relates to, like I said, tax and other bookkeeping issues. Can you just talk a little bit about like what that work entails?
Sure. So it kind of depends on where the business owner is coming from. If they are a first-time business owner, it may be new for them to set up things like workman's comp or payroll tax. And in the case of a cannabis dispensary, they also have to register on the cannabis tax portal. And that's all in addition to regular business and personal taxes that they have to file and pay each year. If someone is coming from the legacy market, those aspects can also be new. The idea of having to pay payroll tax, that it actually costs you money to have employees and that you must pay them on the books and that you must pay your cannabis taxes. You must pay your sales tax on your non-cannabis products. So those who are coming from a world where they've had previous business experience know that they have to file sales tax and they have to file personal and business tax. So the only thing that we're really adding there is the cannabis tax that they have to report.
Can you talk a little bit more? You mentioned this legacy to legal transition. Can you talk about a little bit about what that means and what maybe that process is like for some folks who have made that transition?
Right. So New York has kind of championed that. And I'm so proud to be a New Yorker in which we've prioritized social equity. And we have really tried to find a way that somebody who had spent either years or an entire lifetime selling marijuana can now find a pathway to getting licensed and to participate in a regulated environment. With that comes some responsibilities, right? That license also comes with some responsibilities. And what that means is that they've got to really work within the guidelines and they've got to file and pay taxes.
And So obviously New York State has begun granting licenses to these dispensaries. And as you mentioned, a lot of these small business owners are folks who, they're justice involved individuals, I believe is the state's language there from the Office of Cannabis Management. There's also there's the CARD program, which is an acronym. It's CARD, Conditional Adult Use Retail Dispensaries. Have you worked with folks through that program or is your work separate?
Yes, I have. And in fact, anybody who is licensed and open right now as a dispensary would be part of the CARD program. And those are the justice involved individuals.
Okay. And what are some of those common questions or maybe some concerns you hear when working with folks who are sort of gearing up to open up their own dispensaries? I mean, you kind of alluded to it. There's this element of, having to pay taxes essentially and having to have to pay taxes when you have employees. Is that kind of the biggest one? Are there other issues or commonalities in some of the questions just that folks have had as you kind of help them get set up?
Well, I think it's the idea kind of, just not to simplify it too much, but it's a little bit like coloring in the lines. So there are many business owners who will have employees and they'll pay them cash or they'll send them, in the modern era, they'll send money via Venmo or Cash App or something. And that money isn't really taxed and it's not really reported. So it's incumbent upon the employee to report that income. But really within a regulated industry of any sort, whether it's cannabis or construction or restaurant work, we want people to have protection from a workers' compensation policy. But that also means that we're setting them up on payroll. With payroll comes payroll tax. And so that's a big leap for many, many people, especially for those coming from legacy, but really for anybody. I can't tell you how many people think, oh, no, I'm going to start slow, and I've always paid my people in cash, and we're going to do that until we get to a certain size. And the state says absolutely not. We really do need for you to pay workers' comp. We really do need for you to go through a payroll processor.
And those are all things that are ground level. Otherwise, the business essentially can't operate, right? Or the license won't get granted?
Well, the license would be – actually, no, they would not get the license to actually open, which is the final approval to open the doors.
And so you've also represented clients in administrative hearings before the Office of Cannabis Management. What have you kind of learned about – through those, have you learned much about – the state's sort of rollout of some of the dispensaries? I know it's kind of been a little bit of a longer timeline than I think a lot of folks were hoping for. But have you learned much based on those hearings, or is it more focused on the individuals in those hearings and less about like the process?
It's not so much about the process, although I really did come to an appreciation of the extent to which people open these shops really thinking that they were going to show the state that they were worthy of a license. In other words, if somebody had been kind of dealing with the proverbial hoodie and a backpack, they wanted to show that they could be a responsible business owner. So they signed a lease, they connected with a wholesaler, they operated, regular business hours, they hired people, And they really thought, and part of it is because in the early days of MRTA, the state was saying, we want to see that you can be a responsible business owner. So fast forward, we're almost at the 3-year mark after MRTA has been passed, mm-hmm. and enforcement is coming down. And it's not like often gets painted in the press, which is that these are very greedy individuals or that they wanted to jump the line. They really thought they were playing by the rules.
And we should say the MRTA is the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act, which, yeah, it's coming up on 3 years. As you said, it was March of 2021 that it was that it began, basically.
Correct.
So you've also taught a course at Pace University on cannabis law practice and policy. So I'm pretty curious about this because, and this I assume is always the case in legal scholarship, where the laws often can't keep up with how quickly the world works, essentially, for lack of a better term.
Exactly.
And so I'd imagine in this particular field, like when you're really talking about policy and business sort of intertwined with that, that's rapidly evolving, that is so new. You know, how do you deal with that, I guess, that amount of change as an attorney, but also, like, how do you, you know, approach that to your students? Because I imagine, like, you can't teach it unless you have a handle on it, but it keeps changing, and it's very rapidly changing all the time.
That is an excellent question, and I'm not teaching cannabis law this semester, but I was teaching it last semester. The majority of that time, we were under an injunction because of the Fiore lawsuit, was what we commonly call it, the lawsuit by the Service Disabled Veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say my students were very patient with the syllabus that kept evolving. It was a really, really good opportunity for us to go through actual court documents, you know, because so often in law school, when you study a case, you're looking at very polished case law that's come down from the judge. Whereas in this case, we were looking at filings that in some cases, things were being filed that afternoon, and I was going in to teach a class at 4 p.m.
Oh, wow.
And so in some ways, I think it was a really, really good opportunity for law students to see, this is what it looks like when you file something. It's not that polished thing. And when I say polished, it's not a final product. We get to see the back and forth. We get to see if somebody files something and then somebody files an answer to it. It was really, really a good experience.
And did you get the sense from your students that semester that many of them wanted to go into cannabis law or at least be familiar with it, knowing that it's kind of an emerging field of law as the businesses evolve?
I did. I got the sense that many of them wanted to be knowledgeable about the laws, mostly because they could drive down the street and see all of these unlicensed shops and then hear the talk about the licensed shops. But also, I think there is the awareness that we have this entire industry that is launching in New York. And as people who are about to enter the legal profession, they knew they needed to know something about it. Now, it was interesting because so many of the students came to me privately and said, oh, I really, you know, I'm going to try to get this internship or I'd really like to do this. But then when I, in the class at large, said, now, how many of you really plan to practice cannabis law when you graduate? Nobody.
Hmm.
I guess it was, you know, part of it is, where do you go to get a job?
Right,
and
right.
It's tough. You kind of have to blaze your own trail.
And if you were teaching that class in 2026, only 2 years from now, what do you think the central issues would be? Would they be the same? Would a lot of what reflected in these filings, would that be represented? Do you think the same, or would it evolve? I mean, knowing how quickly this changes, do you think it would kind of be a different, much different course just in 2 years' time?
Oh, I think it's going to be dramatically different because we will have settled law. We will have settled regulations. We will also probably have rewrites of regulations. We will have enforcement regulations that have kind of settled down and been tested in the courts. So I think my syllabus that I wrote for the fall, and by the way, I will be teaching that course in fall of 2024, but I think it'll be essentially the same framework, but the documents that we discuss will be very different.
And so to kind of dig in a little bit in terms of what certain cannabis businesses need, the requirements that they need to have, you know, why can't someone, say, a family member or a friend or somebody, kind of handle the bookkeeping for a cannabis business the way that, you know, if you have another type of small business and maybe that's the arrangement and there's not this kind of scrutiny? Like, what is the added scrutiny that gets placed on these cannabis dispensaries?
I think the added scrutiny comes from what we call 280E, which is an Internal Revenue Code. And it says that no deduction or credit is permissible for a business that deals in a Schedule 1 or 2 substance. Hence the tremendous excitement in the industry over the thought that we might be soon rescheduled or descheduled, rescheduled to Schedule 3 or descheduled. Now, as long as 280E is in effect, a business can only deduct for cost of goods sold. So let's take, if we had a family coffee shop, we could deduct marketing, we could deduct the rent, we could deduct the utilities, so much of what the business incurs as an expense, in addition to what it costs them to buy the coffee or the sugar or the milk or whatever else they have to have, the cups, the saucers, and so forth. Compare that to a cannabis business, and let's look just at a dispensary, and all that business owner can declare as a deduction is actually the cost of goods, the cost of those products that he bought from the farmer or processor. He can't deduct the marketing. He can't deduct even the cost of his license. He can't deduct payroll except for that little bit of time when the employee is literally handing over the product. Any like conference that he attended, and there are a lot in the cannabis industry, any, you know, uniforms that he buys for the workers, he can't deduct those.
That's really interesting. So it really, and there's also kind of aspects of, you know, there is the risk when dealing with the substance that is being sold, right? There are additional concerns about how quickly certain requirements, if they're not met, could lead to legal problems, essentially, right? We're talking about, you know, trafficking concerns or other kind of very heavy, like, legal issues, right?
Well, I think in New York, there has been some evidence of products that are from out of state that should not end up on our New York licensed dispensary shelves, but they are. You'll see instances in which if you peel back the label, it'll show a California sticker. And I'm told that there are products coming in from Oklahoma, from Oregon. But yeah, compliance will be an ongoing issue.
I also had a question because, you know, we've been talking about legal cannabis at the state level, but there is potential federal legislation on the horizon, right? And if that's the case, how do you see that kind of changing these businesses, if at all?
Quite a bit. First of all, with any type of discussion of federal legalization is a federal excise tax. Usually what's talked about is somewhere between 12 and 13%. That will make that product that's delivered to the consumer 12 to 13% more expensive because it's not like the states are going to back down from their taxation rate. So there's that. What we hope, of course, is that with federal legalization, we will have the ability to move products across state lines. The real question comes, will there be room for small brands? In other words, if my little Hudson Valley farmer has such a small scale, can he really compete nationwide? Or might there be some much larger grow operation in the LA area that can ship products across the country to New York and compete much better on price and perhaps on quality? We don't know. The other issue that pops up is, what federal administrator will oversee cannabis? Will it be the FDA? Will it be DEA? Will it be some combination? And in that case, we've got to pay for that. Mm. And won't that be passed along to the consumer?
Mm. Okay. Yeah, so that's certainly something to keep an eye on as we talk about federal legalization. Okay. Well, we've been speaking with Paul Collins, an attorney specializing in tax preparation and cannabis law. We've been talking about dispensaries. Paul, thank you so much for joining us on What's Next.
Thank you.
This has been What's Next on WBFO and WBFO HD1 Buffalo, WOLN Olean, and WUBJ Jamestown, your NPR station.